Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode focuses on the nuclear weapons agreement forged with Iran. We'll look at its benefits, its drawbacks, and the likelihood that it'll be maintained under the Trump administration. In this hour, we'll hear from Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian American Council, and Neil Jock of the Institute for International Studies at Berkeley. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience, and this broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. And now to our moderator, Neil Jock.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be here, seeing familiar faces and such a robust turnout for this very interesting conversation tonight. It's my pleasure and an honor to be here and to introduce our guest, Trita Parsi. He is here as part of talking to those who are interested in learning about the Iran P5+1 deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action limiting the Iran nuclear program. His current book is called Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. I've been reading it with great interest over the last several days, and we will have a good conversation to review the points he's made in that book. By way of introduction, let me just say that Trita is the 2010 recipient of the Grovemeyer Award for Ideas Improving World Order. He's an award-winning author with a focus on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. He's written three books. His first was Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the U.S., which won the Grovemeyer Award and the Council of Foreign Relations Arthur Ross Award in 2008. His second book was entitled A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran, published by Yale University Press. It was selected as the best book of the Middle East in 2012 by Foreign Affairs. And now his latest book reveals the behind-the-scenes story to the historic negotiations, the historic nuclear deal with Iran. Dr. Parsi is the president of the largest Iranian-American grassroots organization in the United States, the National Iranian-American Council. He advised the Obama administration during the negotiations with Iran. He has taught at the Johns Hopkins University and George Washington University and currently teaches at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University in Washington. So the goal tonight is for us to have a conversation, but it's really to provide Trita with an opportunity to talk about his perspective, having been an advisor to the administration during the negotiations and having a deep experience with Iran's government. He was very close to a lot of the negotiators. He was even in a position at one point to have dinner with the negotiating team after one of the sessions. So he's very deeply embedded, in a sense, very knowledgeable about the position of Iran. So we will pursue a range of points with respect to their position, the American position, and so on. But first, I asked him if he would sort of give us a broader sense for the context, the geostrategic context within which the negotiations took place. And so I'll turn it over to Trita to give us a little bit of background in that regard.
Thank you so much, Neil. Really appreciate it. Thank you all for being here. I think it's my third time at the San Francisco World Affairs Council. It's always, always a pleasure to be here. And I'm tremendously happy that I missed the heat wave. Did not expect to have a heat wave in San Francisco. I'm sure you guys are even more surprised than I am. Wanted to give you a bit of a background, not just to the geopolitical context, but first a little bit about the book itself. This is my third book on this topic, the geopolitical rivalries between Iran, Israel, and the United States. But I was really hoping that it would be a bit of a different book. The previous books, I showed how diplomatic opportunities were systematically rejected or missed, driving the situation towards a military confrontation. For this one, finally, we had a triumph of diplomacy, a remarkable achievement in my view that showed what can be achieved when smart policy prevails over this obsession of appearing tough. And certainly, I'm not arguing that a peace was achieved, but rather that an opportunity to lose an enemy actually had been created. And then a certain TV reality star won the elections, and I had to rewrite the last chapter of my book. And we're kind of back to where we were, more or less. But if we understand what went right, I think we might also be able to find a way to reverse the things that have gone wrong. Throughout these negotiations, as Neil mentioned, I was in a rather unique position. I was advising the Obama administration, but also had great access to the Iranian negotiators to get their perspective. It wasn't unusual that I could be at a briefing at the White House early in the week, and then by the end of the week, I had a two-hour private conversation with the Iranian foreign minister. And this gave me an opportunity to really be able to get everyone's perspective, their fears, their calculations, their tactics and strategies. And I thought that I would use this front seat privilege to tell the story of how an international crisis that was literally on the verge of leading to a catastrophic war actually was resolved peacefully without a single shot being fired or a single angry 4 a.m. tweet being written. Or as Trump would put it, the worst deal in history. I thought I would tell that story. And what I would like to do right now before we go into Q&A is to provide you with a bit of a glimpse of the geopolitical context that actually was a key factor both in getting the deal, but also why there was such strong opposition to the deal, particularly from some countries such as Israel and Saudi Arabia. Let me take you to a moment in April 2012. Right at the moment when the U.S. was amassing more sanctions on the Iranians, the Israelis were making threats of taking military action, the Iranians were aggressively going forward with the program, a small number of officials and former officials gathered in a very, very small country in Europe, far away from the eyes of the media. There were several Iranian ambassadors there, including members of the Iranian nuclear negotiating team, several U.S. officials, including a very high-ranking general. And perhaps most surprisingly, a very good-sized delegation from Israel, quite senior figures. But what was most surprising was not who was there, but what actually was said. This is not about enrichment. It was never about enrichment. This was said by a very senior former Israeli official looking straight at the Iranians across the room. For years, we had heard that Iran's nuclear program, particularly its enrichment of uranium, constituted an existential threat to Israel, and that no solution could be found unless the Iranians quit entirely enriching uranium. But instead now, this official was saying that this was actually not about enrichment. It was quite surprising, to say the least. Instead, he argued that Israel wanted to see a sweeping attitude change on behalf of Iran. Israel could not accept that the Iranians rejected Israel's right to exist and that it questioned Israel's right to exist. And Israel was not going to allow the United States to come to terms with Iran if Iran did not come to terms with Israel. If a nuclear deal was struck, by definition, it would put an end to three decades-long policy of isolating and containing Iran. And it would do so, if it was done without the Iranians changing their position on Israel, it would leave Israel abandoned in the region, facing a hostile Iran alone without full American backing. The signal was very clear. Israel would not allow such a deal to be struck and would do everything in its power to stand in its way in order to avoid that scenario. It was not about enrichment. I think this is important to understand, particularly today as we see the criticism of the deal and we see how the Trump administration is trying to find a way out of the deal. And if you notice closely, it is not about nuclear issues. It is not as to whether they kept too many centrifuges. It is primarily about the regional balance of power, which was clearly affected by this deal. So in order to understand what is taking place right now, we have to understand that, particularly from the perspective of Saudi Arabia, a nuclear-armed but isolated Iran was preferred to a non-nuclear Iran, but that was rehabilitated in the region, that had a more functioning relationship with the United States, that was accepted as a major power in the region. That's what this is about right now, much more so than whether Iran has too many centrifuges or if there's enough sites that are being inspected or not. I'll stop there.
Thank you for that introduction. Israel, of course, was not party to the negotiations themselves. So the comment that it was not about enrichment was their perspective. But you bring up the larger context of this being a geopolitical competition, if you will, between Israel and Iran. But let me go back to your book and to the discussions as well. Certainly, enrichment was high on the list of concerns for American negotiators. In fact, the negotiations took place in secret initially between the United States and Iran, and there was a good deal of concern on the American part. Most of the negotiations, of course, were handled by the nonproliferation specialists within the U.S. administration. That was the focus, and as you say in the book, once the specialists, the technical experts, the Department of Energy chief Ernie Moniz and his counterpart, Mr. Salehi, got involved, the final steps could be taken and the final ink could be dried on the agreement. But underneath the issue of nuclear uranium enrichment was the issue of weapons and whether or not Iran both had an interest in developing weapons and whether or not they had the capacity to develop weapons. So I'd like to sort of pursue that a little bit, at least to get it out front and center, but also given our conversation before, to give you a chance to, if you like, try and get it off the table. So regarding the Iranian nuclear weapons program, someone we both know well, Gary Seymour, who is a former colleague of mine, but was Obama's chief nonproliferation advisor, said in public talk not very long ago that the Obama administration had given Iran a pass on their nuclear weapons program. On page 369, and I have read the book carefully, so I'll try and cite exactly what I'm looking at, you note that John Kerry remarked that Iran has developed experience with a nuclear fuel cycle, and we can't bomb that knowledge away, nor can we sanction that knowledge away. So clearly Kerry recognized that the knowledge that was gained with respect to enrichment was there and was going to be kept. However, since that same comment can be made about nuclear weapons knowledge, and given that the IAEA cannot inspect military sites in Iran, do you agree with, again, a quote you cited from President Obama, who said that the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, allowed the U.S. and the world to verify that Iran's nuclear program is peaceful and that it cannot build a nuclear weapon?
Thank you, Neil. Short answer to the latter part of the question, yes, I do agree with the former president on that issue, but I think there's a premise in your question that I don't think is entirely correct. The agreement gives the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, access to the entirety of Iran's nuclear program, every phase of it. The IAEA is essentially inside of the program. It's not like in the past, you guys remember what happened in Iraq, in which the inspections run around and knock on doors. Instead, now the instruments are inside the program, and they send signals to Vienna, where the IAEA headquarters are. So if the Iranians were to do anything, it would be detected very quickly by these instruments. You actually don't need to necessarily just have the inspectors there. The military sites, then we're talking about non-nuclear sites. There, the Iranians are currently implementing the additional protocol, which has a managed access component to it. If there is evidence that the Iranians are doing something that is fishy and suspicious, then any country can take that information and give it to the IAEA. If the IAEA finds that to be credible, they request access to those military sites. That will be a 24-day process. There's a voting structure put into place in which essentially, as long as the Europeans and the U.S. are on the same side, the Iranians will always lose, and they will have to give access to those sites unless they would then be in violation. The question that has come up now, however, is that there is no credible evidence of anything, but rather the Trump administration has tried to use that to put pressure on the IAEA to request access even in the absence of any evidence. The IAEA has resisted this because they don't want to see themselves be abused again the way they were during the Iraq War, what led to the Iraq War. And also because ultimately, for the inspections to be able to work, the credibility of the IAEA is essential. If the IAEA requests access 3-4 times based on no evidence, and every time they come up with nothing, it undermines the IAEA. and it makes it more difficult to actually be able to get access to sites in Iran when something fishy actually might be happening. So the IAEA has a self-interest in making sure not abusing this mechanism, but only use it when there actually is credible evidence. According to the State Department itself, when Nikki Haley went and spoke to the IAEA, I believe it was last week, she did not go there and present any new evidence that would be actionable for the IAEA. Instead, she went there and essentially asked them to do this without evidence. So this is important to understand. If there is good cause to believe that something is there, there is a mechanism that would allow the IAEA to get into sites that are not nuclear or declared nuclear. But we have to be very careful not to abuse that. Otherwise, it in and of itself can collapse the deal.
Mm-hmm. Now, those who opposed the agreement initially and those who continue to oppose it, of course, are concerned that much of weapon development, weapon research and design is basically working on a blackboard and is not something that is dependent on testing. And they'll cite the original U.S. Nuclear weapons in the 1940s as having been tested, but they were never in doubt as to whether or not they would work. And so there continues to be this concern that absence of leading indicators about what's going on is necessarily a confidence builder, given that in the past there was a development by Iran in secret about both its development, its ability to enrich uranium and its work on nuclear weapons. So I'm sure there may be questions from the floor subsequently, but it continues to be a point of real concern in the West.
But there's an issue. Well, there's probably concerns in some places, but you also have to take the totality of the deal into account. The Iranians had more than 10,000 kilos of low-enriched uranium prior to the deal. They had a stockpile of that size. That stockpile is, if they re-enrich it to higher levels, could provide enough highly enriched uranium for approximately 10 nuclear weapons. A blackboard will not develop a nuclear weapon. You actually have to have the fissile material. As a result of the deal, 98% of that stockpile is shipped out, and the Iranians will not be allowed to have more than 400 kilos of low-enriched uranium at any point. You need 1,200 kilos to perfectly make a weapon. If they only have 400, they may have a lab somewhere in which they're making calculations, but they simply won't have the material to do the bomb. So as a result, when you take into account the totality of it, without the material, it doesn't matter what they have on their blackboards.
Let me ask you to talk a little bit about some of the other points you made in the book that are of interest generally and perhaps as we go forward. You cite several missed opportunities for resolution and cooperation between Iran and the United States. A very important incident was after the 9/11 attack at the Bonn conference in 2001. There was an opportunity for substantial cooperation that was made available by Iran. The U.S. government was not receptive to that, so that was a missed opportunity. You also cite in 2005 when Iran put a more generous offer on the table than what was ultimately agreed in the JCPOA. Again, it was rejected by the Bush administration. And then you note that the 2010 Tehran agreement, Tehran announcement, that came through cooperation discussions between Iran with Turkey and with Brazil was also not received well in the West. So there were these different opportunities that were missed for cooperation. Let me take that issue of missed opportunities in a slightly different direction. The Obama administration in 2009, after the Iranian elections, as you put it, had a timid response to the very strong opposition in the street to what was considered and concluded as a fraudulent election in 2009. Do you think that was a missed opportunity by the United States to support Iranian opposition to the theocratic regime and bring about a different regime in Iran that would have a different view entirely about Iran's place in the world, both in terms of its nuclear capabilities and in terms of the balance you described at your in your opening remarks as a regional power?
By end of 2009, the Iranians missed an opportunity because there was an offer on the table in which they couldn't say yes to, or which was a mistake on their end. When it comes to what happened in the summer of 2009, when there were fraudulent elections, and I'm sure everyone remembers the horrific scenes on the streets in which the Iranian government was very heavy-handed and brutally clamping down, I think the Obama administration committed a couple of mistakes early on. They did not condemn the violence. They were careful. They didn't want to take sides in that conflict in the sense of proclaiming to know whether there had been fraud or not, knowing very well that the reformist and the green movement in Iran actually was not looking for an American endorsement. It's not a plus within the Iranian political context. But they were very slow in condemning the violence, which needs to be condemned regardless of whether there was fraud or not. Those were massive human rights abuses. But the idea that had they more forcefully acted against that, that there would be a dramatically different future, I have not found evidence for. I interviewed the inner circle around Mousavi, who was the leader of the Green Movement, and trying to see, you know, exactly what did you want the U.S. government to do, what should they say, etc. And the main answer was, we were busy with our own problems, and what the U.S. did or did not do was really not particularly high on our list of concerns. And it was quite an eye-opening for me, because you're sitting over here and you think the United States is the center of the universe, and you realize that over there there's something massive going on, and while the U.S. is a factor, it was not at all as big of a factor that I think many people here thought or would like to think. The idea, furthermore, that had the Green Movement won, they would have pursued a dramatically different route on the nuclear program, also lacks evidence. In fact, part of the reason why the Iranians missed the opportunity later on in 2009 was because of the massive criticism from the Green Movement to the offer that was on the table, precisely because they didn't want to have the Ahmadinejad government be able to score any political points by striking a deal with the U.S. When it comes to the issue of the nuclear program, the consensus within the Iranian elite is much within the elite, which means the regime itself, whether you're reformist or not, is much, much stronger than I think people in Washington might want to believe. It is not so that there was a faction there that actually wanted to give up enrichment. On that core issue, they were extremely united. And in fact, during that summer, there were some concerns, perhaps not so much in Washington as elsewhere in the West, that Mousavi and the Green Movement might be tougher to negotiate with because they would have much stronger popular support and would be much, much better at handling pressure from the West than the tremendously reckless Ahmadinejad government.
Do you have any sense that that calculation entered into the Obama administration's response to the events on the ground?
The main thing that was going on in their minds was, which no one knew at the time, is that there actually had been a small opening on the nuclear issue a week prior to the Iranian elections. That the Iranians had sent a letter to the IEA requesting to buy fuel. The IEA had immediately contacted the U.S. and said there's an opportunity here because instead of selling the Iranians the fuel for their reactor, we can ask them to give up their own enriched uranium and use that to build the fuel. And that way we get rid of their stockpile, which was so critical, and the Iranians get what they want. So the U.S. then saw a great opportunity to be able to resolve, at least in the short term, making sure that the Iranians wouldn't have enough of a stockpile to build a bomb. So I think the president at the time was very focused on that, recognizing that this was a great opportunity and perhaps felt that the election issue was kind of coming in the midst of that and complicating that issue. But no one knew about this going on in the background at the time.
Throughout the book, you describe the missed opportunities and the engagement and the kind of talking past one another that seemed to mark the U.S.-Iran discussions, both in secret and then in public. But you also introduce an interesting concept that the Iranians used, and let me ask you about that. As you describe it, it's the concept of heroic flexibility. And as you describe it in the book, it seems to capture how Iran addressed its own unwillingness to engage with an enemy, as they saw it, that was in a certain sense beyond the pale, frequently referred to as the great Satan. And yet at a key moment, this concept of heroic flexibility came in. Can you tell us more about that and whether or not we can anticipate that kind of flexibility ability with respect to resolving other issues of concern between the U.S. and Iran.
Just because it was called heroic flexibility doesn't mean it was particularly flexible. Let's just first get that straight. but it's a very interesting issue because I think we tend to view the Iranian government as very, very ideological. And that's exactly, I think, the way they would like to be perceived. In reality, they're far more Machiavellian than ideological. And they show they're very flexible on issues when they need to be in order to advance their own interest and be able to survive. We actually do ourselves a disfavor of viewing them too ideologically because then we miss how they actually can maneuver in ways that we may not be able to anticipate that. What is very interesting, this happened in September 2013. And Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, had been very, very insistent for a decade that Iran would not give in on the issue of enrichment. That was Iran's complete, unnegotiable red line. Then suddenly in September 2013, he comes out with his speech. And what the Iranians always do is that when they want to shift their position, they find some passage in the Quran, some religious text to be able to justify it. And there's a story in the Quran about a specific moment in which an important individual there shifted his position and explained that as heroic flexibility. And that's what he used, and suddenly you saw the Iranians adopt in public a different posture. It's in that September where negotiations behind the scenes really intensify, and the U.S. and Iran actually very closely, first in Oman, later in New York, negotiate an interim deal. What no one knew, at least outside at the time, was that secret negotiations had happened for about almost a year. And 6 months prior to that heroic flexibility speech, the United States had actually indicated in a very convincing way to the Iranians that the U.S. now finally had come to accept Iran's red line and accept enrichment in Iran. And as a result, you saw the negotiations take up significant speed, and that's when he comes out and starts talking about heroic flexibility. The flexibility came after the concession from the U.S., not before.
So what I'm hearing is that we can't look forward to a sudden dawning of heroic flexibility as we look at the other contentious issues, whether it be with respect to Hezbollah or recognition of Israel or the missile program on the part of Iran's leadership.
I think we can end up being surprised on some of those issues, but I think some of those issues are probably more difficult than the enrichment issue. You're not going to see, there's always been this hope in Washington that something could be done to be able to break the relationship between Hezbollah and Iran. Remember early on when the Syrian crisis emerged, there was this hope that if we can get Syria out of the Iranian camp, that would be a major blow to them geopolitically, and perhaps one could even offer Assad something to switch sides. What is ironic is that just today, the Trump administration essentially dumped Europe before the Iranians dumped Hezbollah. If you look at how the relationships have lasted and which ones have been broken, etc., we're seeing more fractures on this side than we do there. That doesn't mean that it can't happen. I'm just saying that if you're sitting in Tehran and the way that they see the region, you have to recognize that the Iranians, Iran is a majority Shia, majority Persian state in a region that is overwhelmingly Sunni and Arab. Iran has no natural friends. Just like Israel, Iran has been looking at pockets of populations throughout the region to be able to create what they hope to be more tenable alliances. The Israelis had this, they called it the periphery doctrine, in which they invested in every non-Arab population in the region, whether it's Maronite Christians in Lebanon, Kurds in Iraq, or the Iranians, which they invested in heavily prior to the revolution. The Iranians have done the same thing primarily when it comes to Shiite populations and have that relationship with Hezbollah since the mid-1980s or early 1980s, but the relationship with the Shia population in Lebanon stretches back 500 years. I think we are likely going to be more successful if the approach is to see how can we change the conduct and the policies than to think that there can be dramatic shifts in the alliances, particularly when we are not offering anything of particular value and also not showing a tremendous amount of confidence that an alliance with the United States would be particularly tenable.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Trita Parsi of the National Iranian American Council and Neil Jock of the Institute for International Studies at Berkeley. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now back to our moderator, Neil Jock.
Personality seems to have played an important role in the negotiations and the change from President Bush to President Obama and the people who were involved. We saw a lot of sort of positive bilateral relations. For example, Moniz and Salehi, Kerry and Zarif, they seemed to get along well. Bill Burns and Jalili and so on, even Obama and Rouhani.
No one got along with Jalili. Even Nick Burns did not get along with Jalili. I can go into the
perhaps
details.
Perhaps the wish was father to thought as I was reading your book then that I saw more in Jalili than was there. But in any case, there seemed to be a common commitment to a successful outcome at a certain point, that in a certain sense their personal investment in that was perhaps more important than the objective information and the national interests at work. And so I wonder whether or not is the permanence, the durability of the agreement, unfortunately subject to the personalities involved, to the personnel who were there, and that being extremely variable, are we then living on borrowed time with respect to the durability of the JCPOA?
I think clearly personalities do matter. You needed someone like Kerry, for instance, to be able to negotiate effectively with the Iranians. You needed someone from the Iranian side, such as Zarif, who has spent time in this city, going to school here, and who in some ways may actually have spent more time outside of Iran than inside of Iran in the last 30 years, who is fully fluent, not only in English, but in American culture. You needed some of these variables in order to be able to succeed. One, for instance, in particular, President Obama had an almost unprecedented capacity to put himself in the shoes of the other side to see things from their perspective. This is crucial in any negotiation because that's how you manage to figure out what are their next moves, what is the real issue that they're concerned about, what is it that is probably just rhetoric, and what's the real bottom line. You have to have that capacity. But to go as far as to say that the deal is dependent or that perhaps they sacrifice national interests because of the personal chemistry, I've not seen any evidence for again. I mean, remember, these negotiations took 20 months to complete. They ran through three deadlines that were supposed to be final deadlines, and they went beyond them. If this was supposed to be such a love affair between them that they actually set aside real concerns because they had just, you know, had such amazing personal chemistry, this would probably have taken much less than 20 months. But personalities do matter, though, because, for instance, when the 10 American sailors, just a couple of days before the implementation of the deal, U.S. sailors accidentally drifted into Iranian waters in January 2016 and got caught by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. Because of the personal rapport between Kerry and Zarif, they had spent so much time with each other, they managed to resolve that issue in 16 hours. All of the sailors got out. No one was harmed. Whereas, unfortunately, under normal circumstances, something like this could have taken several months, if not years. This could have ended up being another Iranian hostage crisis. It didn't. That was largely because the rapport between the two sides had become so strong that they actually had developed at least a little bit of trust, and they could resolve this issue. Now we have a scenario in which 6-7 months into the Trump administration, Tillerson has not picked up the phone to continue that relationship with Zarif. So if something really bad happens, if we have another case of American sailors accidentally getting into Iranian waters, it's going to be much, much more difficult to resolve that.
I'm not at all surprised that we have a number of very thoughtful and very direct questions from the floor. And so rather than responding, I will turn to the floor for questions. First off, who really speaks for Iranian foreign policy, the supreme leader or the president, who are often at odds?
The Iranians have a very deliberately confusing dualistic system. It is, however, not currently as contradictory as the American system, we have to be honest and admit. On the nuclear issue in particular, they're far more consistent. But one has to recognize, though, that there are lengthy periods, particularly prior to this nuclear deal, in which they were contradicting each other, at times deliberately. They have a concept, which I think is ultimately a very self-defeating concept, which they called simulated irrationality. The idea that you act in a way that you come across as a little bit irrational because you can't really figure out what the logic is of what they're doing. It is essentially the same as Nixon's madman theory, in which he thought by acting crazy, the Russians would be more constrained, they would be more careful because it's more difficult to calculate your next move. It is a concept that the Iranians have used, and part of it is to have these contradictory statements. It is ultimately self-defeating. It only adds uncertainty. Uncertainty creates insecurity, and in the long run, this is going to be not just bad for the Iranians, but for everyone in the region. We have to work to be able to bring the entire region, not just the Iranians, essentially, we need to have a paradigm shift of what we understand to be security, to shelf this balance of power paradigm that is dominating the region and move towards collective security. This deal actually opened the path for an all-inclusive security dialogue. In fact, just months after the deal was struck, the Geneva Conference on Syria started to become a little bit more serious. And for the first time, not only were the Iranians there at the table, sitting straight across the table from the Saudis, but it was actually the United States now that insisted that Iran has to be at the table. And President Obama even called the then king of Saudi Arabia to tell him, you cannot boycott this. You have to be at the table. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. But ultimately, that is the only path to being able to stabilize the region, to get these countries that unfortunately right now are not talking, getting on talking terms. A key obstacle was the nuclear program in Iran. It had to be resolved before the U.S. would be willing to accept Iran at the table and before the Europeans would be pushing for it. And this was actually even more important for the Europeans than it was for the U.S.
One of the questions from the floor has to do with the role Oman played in the negotiations, and you cite in the book a fairly substantial role that Oman played. And the question then was, is there a role for others to play that kind of positive role in terms of bringing the, let's call them, hostile parties together for other discussions? But then in a linked question, one of the people from the floor asks whether or not Trump's opening to Saudi Arabia and his rejection of the rapprochement with Iran enables Russia to play a more powerful role. And what is your view with respect to that possibility?
Interesting. Good question. Let me start off on Oman, if I might, because I think they do deserve a tremendous amount of credit. Every American-Iranian official I interviewed gave them a tremendous amount of credit, ranging from being indispensable to being pivotal. What happened was that as the U.S. was pushing sanctions, the Iranians were expanding their program, there were essentially two clocks or three clocks they were ticking. Would the U.S. sanctions be able to cripple the Iranian economy first? Would the Iranians be able to present the world and the United States with a nuclear fait accompli first? Or would the Israelis just shock everyone by taking military action? And the problem for the U.S. side was to be able to make sure that their clock was faster than the other clocks. The official negotiations turned out to be a complete, I'm not going to say waste of time, but it was not a very good way of actually conducting real negotiations. They were extremely formal. In fact, prior to Rouhani getting elected, the Iranians insisted that once the talks were to begin, all of the other delegations would have to be at the table and be seated. Once they were seated, the Iranians would walk in. Once the session ended, the Iranians would stand up first, walk out, and once they were out of the room, the others were allowed to stand up. The reason was because they didn't want to have any side chit-chats, no one going, grabbing a little bit more coffee and tea and being able to communicate. And the negotiations were essentially just a competition of speeches. They were giving speeches, and they were repeating speeches. You mentioned Jalili earlier on. He used to give like three-hour sessions going over his PhD thesis. It was excruciatingly painful. And so it was leading anywhere. So the president recognized that there needed to be an authoritative channel that was backed by Iran's supreme leader, in which both the U.S. could test various things, but more importantly, be able to see how much of an impact are the sanctions having. Are the Iranians ready to capitulate on this crucial issue of enrichment? So there was one country in the region that had this unique capacity of being able to really get along with the United States and Iran at the same time, and that is Oman. They had played a critical role in getting three Americans from this city released a couple of years ago. You all heard about the three hikers, Sarah, Josh, and Shane. It was the Omanis that handled that whole thing. And by doing that, they proved to the Obama administration that they have this unique capacity of getting the Iranians to deliver. They did it because they were really terrified that this nuclear issue would lead to a military confrontation and would further destabilize the region, just as the Iraq war had. So they pushed themselves forward and wanted to see if they could help. The president okayed it. John Kerry played a critical role in all of this. He was senator at the time. And a deep believer of diplomacy. And in those in the second round of the first round was a complete disaster. The U.S. sent two officials mid-level. The Iranians sent, I think, three or four. One of them was a deputy foreign minister, so he actually never entered the room once he saw that the Americans were lower ranked. And the U.S. went there to essentially see, is this really a serious channel, and are the Iranians ready to capitulate? The Iranians went there not to capitulate, but to see, is the U.S. ready to capitulate? And they bombarded the U.S. with various formulations of how to accept enrichment. The U.S. side could not entertain any of those. They were not authorized to give any talk about that at all. Then the U.S., so it was a failure. The U.S. elections happened, so nothing could take place then. But then by January 2013, a new sense of urgency had come over the White House. I'm going to take a little bit longer for this answer because I think this is important. In January 2012, Leon Panetta, who was the then Secretary of Defense, had publicly stated that Iran's breakout time, the time it would take for them to build the bomb, was 12 months. By January 2013, as a result of the Iranians aggressively going forward with their nuclear program as a way to pressure the U.S. and counter-pressure the U.S. because of the sanctions, Iran's nuclear breakout capacity had shrunk to 8 to 12 weeks. It had become increasingly clear that the Iranian nuclear clock was ticking faster than the sanctions clock. If nothing else changed, it was far more likely that if the United States stayed the course, Iran would either present the U.S. with a nuclear fait accompli or there would be war. The likelihood of Iran capitulating was increasingly shrinking because the sanctions simply didn't have the same capacity as the Iranians had when it came to expanding their nuclear program. So the U.S. went back to Oman in March 2013. Ahmadinejad is still president. But this time they went with a much higher delegation. Bill Burns, who's the number two at the State Department at the time, essentially the level of deputy foreign minister. But most importantly, for the first time ever, the U.S. was ready to present a formulation of how it could accept enrichment on Iranian soil. Was a very, very carefully crafted statement. This is exactly what the Iranians had looked for more than 10 years, acceptance of their red line. But it wasn't enough because the Iranians could not go back to Tehran with just an oral statement. They needed it in writing. And the U.S. was absolutely not willing to put anything in writing because if they did, it could cause major problems in the P5+1 negotiations. And they were also afraid that the Iranians would just pocket this concession without giving anything in return. So despite the fact that this very major thing had happened, the lack of trust between the two sides was still a major problem. And the question was, who could bridge this trust gap? Who is the common Facebook friend that Obama and Khamenei have that could get them together? Well, essentially, probably only one person on this planet, and that's the Sultan of Oman. Once again, he stepped in. And the way it was done was this. It was very clever. Instead of the U.S. putting in writing and sending it to the Iranians, which was out of the question, the U.S. would write a letter to the Sultan explaining America's position on enrichment and under what conditions it would be willing to accept enrichment in Iran. The Sultan would then travel to Tehran in between his chemotherapy, not with the letter, but only conveying orally what was in that letter. And he would meet face to face with Khamenei to do so. And he did. If the Iranians then rejected, it was not because of their mistrust of the United States, but they would essentially say, we don't trust you, Sultan of Oman, which they couldn't because they had such a strong relationship. So the trust gap between the U.S. and Iran was bridged by the Sultan. And I think it's important because in this era in which we hear so much about Sunni-Shia rifts and Arab-Persian tensions, it was an Arab country that brought the United States and Iran together.
Now, that was a very interesting part of your book, but and I'm glad you retold it, but can you then use that as a basis for talking a little bit more about future opportunities, both for Oman or others like Oman, and whether or not Russia has some special access now, given the Trump approach?
The Russians are not going to do any particular favors to the United States. They were actually very, very constructive in these negotiations. In fact, if there was any country the American diplomats praised, it was mainly the Russians, because they had leverage over the Iranians, and they used it oftentimes. And they were very constructive. It was quite surprising to everyone, because this all happened in the middle of the Ukraine crisis. But it never affected the negotiations, and it was quite an achievement in and of itself. But the Russians are not going to be in the mood of using that in order to make things easier for the United States. And there's another problem here. When Trump went to Riyadh, he had audience with all of the Arab countries of the GCC, including one with the Sultan. But he deliberately canceled that meeting last minute. And it was aimed to send a signal of Trump's displeasure of the role that Oman had played in bringing about the nuclear deal. So here's the thing. No country is going to step in and resolve these conflicts and mediate or facilitate between the United States and Iran or any other country if they're going to be punished for it. So I don't see any volunteers at this point. And there's not going to be any volunteers until there is an active sense that it would be welcomed both in Tehran and in Washington.
Now, continuing with this theme, there are a couple of questions about Europe's role, and let me ask those. First, are the Europeans and Iran preparing to go ahead with the deal without the U.S., and what kind of effect will it have on the U.S.'s diplomatic legitimacy in the world? And then the second connected question is, can you speak more to the European calculus on the latest developments?
The Europeans are extremely frustrated and perplexed, I would say, but what has been happening. And it's obviously not just on the Iran front, it's what happened to NATO, it's what happened to the Paris Agreement. Trump went to Riyadh and said, we're not here to criticize our allies. 3 days later, he's in Brussels and he did nothing but criticize American allies. But he wouldn't criticize the Saudis. And also because at least key individuals early on in the Trump administration, like Steve Bannon, had made it very clear it lied in America's interest, according to him, that the European Union be split apart. That it should not be dealing with the Union as a whole, but deal with individual countries. And as you all saw, Trump was quite friendly with Nigel Farage, who led the Brexit. So there's been a very unease sense from the Europeans on this issue. If there's one major flaw, perhaps one could say, with the agreement, I'm sure there's plenty, but one major that was really overseen is that in all of the preparations on what to do if the Iranians cheated, how to snap back sanctions, there was no one who envisioned what happens if a Trump becomes president of the United States. What are the mechanisms in that deal to ensure that the deal could survive American hostility towards the deal? There is a slight hope that even if the U.S. withdraws, that the Europeans would stick to the deal. I mean, they would stick to the deal. The question is whether the Iranians would stick to the deal. Now, the Iranian head of the Atomic Energy Agency, the Iranian Atomic Energy Agency, Salehi, who was also part of the negotiations, came out a week and a half ago and said that if the Europeans and the others live up to their commitments, Iran would as well. That might be an interesting statement. It would be very good if it was true. But I'm afraid that that might more be an effort by the Iranians to further position themselves as being the really reasonable partner and put the United States in an even more isolated and unreasonable category by showing themselves to be willing to go beyond what the agreement actually requires. I still have doubts that they would, because it's not just about whether they like to be nice or whether they... it's about whether the economic benefits of the deal will survive if the United States starts to reimpose sanctions on European companies that are now doing legal trade with Iran. If the Europeans are willing to protect those companies from congressional sanctions, then perhaps it can survive. But if they're not, and if the companies stop trading with Iran because they don't want to lose access to the American market, it doesn't matter what the European governments do, the Iranians are not likely going to stick with this deal. The Iranians are in compliance right now, but if they are not getting the benefits of being in compliance, no one should have the expectation that they will continue to be in compliance.
Well, President Trump may be following Netanyahu's view that the JCPOA paved the way for Iran to develop nuclear weapons rather than obstructing the path. In that vein, we had a question that's somewhat more technical, and it reads as follows. Can you please review the timing of the restrictions on what happens after 10 years?
I'll go briefly into that, but I'll say something else about Netanyahu that I think is interesting. The restrictions on the deal is that there was an attempt to try to make this step-by-step symmetric. So, for instance, the Iranians right now are implementing the additional protocol, but they will ratify it in year 8, which would be 2023, if then the U.S. on year 8 lifts sanctions through congressional action. Right now, American sanctions are waived. They still are on the books, but the president has a right to waive them, and he has to do so every 120 days, 180 days. But in year 8, they would be lifted, which is a permanent measure, and then the Iranians would ratify the additional protocol, which is also a permanent measure. Then by year 10 and by year 15, a lot of the restrictions on the size of the Iranian enrichment program would end up being lifted, because the pathway of the deal is this. The Iranians did something illegal in the past. They need to be punished for it, and they have been through the sanctions. But there needs to be a pathway for them to be able to regain the confidence of the international community. And once they have done so, they should have the same rights and privileges and responsibilities as any other NPT signatory, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The deal does not make any effort to permanently punish Iran for something they did in the past, but rather say, here's the punishment and here's the path you have to walk in order to be able to become an NPT member in good compliance. So by year 15, if everything has gone well, and if they have not cheated, and if the U.S. has not cheated, and if the U.S. does what it is obligated to do, such as lifting the sanctions on year 8, then at that point, Iran would essentially become a normal NPT power, with one exception, which is it would continue to implement the additional protocol, which is the most important aspect of the inspections regime, in the sense that it would give much greater access to the IAEA, to their program, than any normal NPT power who has not signed the additional protocol. But can I say something about Netanyahu? We saw how Netanyahu, you mentioned that he said that the deal paves the way for Iran to get the bomb. And he went to Congress. He really positioned himself as being the number one enemy of the deal. And he did everything he could, including leaking information about the negotiation, which he was given to him by the United States in the briefings, in order to undermine the negotiations. But there was one thing he could have done, a very simple thing that would have been much more effective in killing this deal than any of the speeches, any of the press conferences, or any of the talks he gave in Congress. All he needed to do was to go to the podium, grab the mic, and say, "This is a fantastic deal. We in Israel love this deal. This is Iran's biggest defeat. And we're so happy that it's done." The Iranian foreign minister himself told me that had he gone out and praised the deal, it would have probably been the end of the negotiations, because the Iranian negotiators could not handle him claiming that this is Iran's defeat. They had no problem. In fact, they welcomed all of the talk about this is such a great deal for Iran, this paves the way for them to do this and that, because he actually helps shut up all the critics, the hardliners in Iran. But if he had gone out and hugged the deal, it would have created far more difficulty for the Iranians to continue with the negotiations.
We can't end this on a light note. We have to be realistic after all. But the World Affairs Council is always happy to have student involvement in our programs. And so this is an opportune time for us to end with a question from one of the high school students here in the audience. So in conclusion, last question, and as always, there are more questions and more smart people in the room than we can actually accommodate, but let me end with this question. You stated that Tillerson has not continued negotiations with Zarif. What is the future of the U.S. relationship with Iran, and will Tillerson be able to build back this positive relationship with Iran, and if so, how?
It's a great question. Yeah, so Tillerson has not picked up the phone, it took more than 2 years to rebuild a small modicum of rapport between Zarif and Kerry after 35, 36 years of silence between U.S. secretaries of state and Iran foreign ministers. I would say most of that has at this point been lost. But it doesn't mean that it can't be rebuilt, and it can. The question is whether Tillerson can, because at the end of the day, just as much as an earlier question asked, who is calling the shots in Iran, who's actually making the foreign policy, is it the foreign minister, is it the president, is it the supreme leader? A similar question can be asked. Who's making the foreign policy of the United States right now? Is it Tillerson and Mattis who go to the region and negotiate between Qatar and Saudi to try to put an end to that conflict and actually make some progress? And in the midst of their negotiations, Trump comes out with a tweet lambasting Qatar and just completely eliminates all of the gains that Tillerson had made? What is the value of talking to Tillerson if he doesn't carry that weight, if he doesn't have the trust and the confidence of the president? I think we have some of those major issues right now. But I would insist on this. What this negotiation showed is that even between countries like Iran and the United States that unfortunately have had such a bad history, there are ways to resolve these issues when both sides take more reasonable position and when they actually truly invest in diplomacy. Diplomacy had never truly been invested in the way that it was right now. I mean, the time that they spent with each other, the effort that they made, their refusal to accept defeat. They had the same commitment to peacemaking that usually you see militaries having to winning wars. And that's the type of commitment that is needed. If that commitment is found, that political will is found on the American and the Iranian side in the future, certainly things can be improved. But in the short run, unfortunately, it does not appear particularly likely. The Trump administration is far more likely to look for ways and potentially find ways to justify a withdrawal from the agreement, which most likely is going to be based on not nuclear concerns, but non-nuclear concerns. And this will put the region back into a very negative spiral. Just as much as this deal very much was struck because of the fact that the president recognized that if he didn't invest in diplomacy, war would be very likely. It took two negative outcomes off the table, war with Iran and an Iranian nuclear bomb. Going away from this deal will bring those two very bad outcomes back on the table. The Iranians are likely going to restart the program and talk about war with Iran, who's going to attack, when, etc., is once again going to resurface.
The book is Losing an Enemy, and our guest is Trita Parsi. Thank you very much for being here with us tonight.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public and conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian American Council, and Neil Jock, research scholar at the Institute for International Studies at Berkeley. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.